From Contamination to Purification, commentary for the February 29th, 2020 Sabbath School lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns, standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged toward the west, and the north, and the south. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. Daniel 8, verses 3 and 4. With this chapter, we return to the Hebrew portion of Daniel, which we left for the Aramaic shortly after chapter 1. While the Aramaic portion was framed in the chiasm of chapters 2 and 7, chapter 8 seems to find a need to repeat again, in similar fashion, the imagery of chapter 7, this time with a ram and a goat. However, the imagery is not a perfect fit. Instead of four beasts, there are only two. Some feel that the first beast was eliminated because Babylon was already passing from the scene. But according to the text, this was only the third year of Belshazzar's reign. This was likely almost two decades before the handwriting on the wall scene where judgment was finally passed on Babylon. The more likely reason is that this was written sometime well after the events regarding Babylon and its successor on the world stage. The two-horned ram we begin with here is often equated with Medo-Persia, and the single-horned goat with Alexander the Great, who defeated the Persian ruler Darius III at the Battle of Issus in 333 BC. After Alexander died about 10 years later, his empire was fought over by Ptolemy I, Seleucus I, Lysimachus, and Antigonus I. The wars raged on for 40 years, and in the process, Alexander's son, Alexander IV, the legitimate heir, was killed. The transition was not as smooth or complete as the symbology of Daniel would lead us to believe. The four horns of the goat that replaced the one horn are equated by some to these four individuals who fought over the remnants of Alexander's empire. While the four horns may be paired off with the four heads of the leopard-like beast in the previous chapter, no such equivalence exists in the image in Daniel chapter 2. But in the literary chiasm of the Aramaic portion of the book, chapter 7 may be seen as a further clarification of chapter 2. If that was the intent of chapter 8, the author stumbles somewhat in forgetting about the terrible beast with iron teeth as the intermediary between the four horns or heads and the horn which assumes ascendancy. This hints at a later attempt to adjust the prophetic symbolism to support what may be felt to be correct facts on a more informed perspective achieved after some of the events have already played out. While the ten horns of the terrible beast in chapter 7 make way for a new horn by displacing three among the ten, the goat of chapter 8 only has four horns, and the new horn that arises only displaces one of those four predecessors. If that horn is equivalent to the new horn that arises from the ten-horned beast, and if, as some state, those ten horns are the ten toes of the statue in chapter 2 and represent ten kingdoms, where are those ten kingdoms in the imagery of chapter 8? Especially, where are they if this is an attempt at chiasm to add further clarification to the previous symbols? There seems to be a breakdown here, as though Daniel no longer understood his own visions from the past. The new list of symbols works a little, but only up to a point. Unable to envision the rise of a further world power beyond the partitioning that had taken place after Alexander's death, only the possibility of a power rising from the existing four may have been seen as possible. Would Egypt, Macedon, Anatolia, or Mesopotamia rise to rule? Those may have seemed the only options, and none of them were the power that would eventually rise far to the west, Rome. Rome was unique. According to legend, refugees from the Battle of Troy, at least 600 years before Daniel's captivity in Babylon, landed on the Italian peninsula, where they eventually grew powerful enough to seize the area from the Etruscans, who already lived there. They did not grow to power from one of Alexander's horns, predating him by centuries. The book of Daniel is dated to around the 2nd century BC. And since Rome did not involve itself in Palestine until the end of the Maccabean Revolt, the writer of chapter 8, relying on personal knowledge and extant oral or written histories rather than actual visions, even if he were writing during the revolt itself, had no way of knowing about Rome or the importance it would play in future events. Instead, the historical Syrian enemy to the north may have been perceived to be the threat, just as it was long before the Babylonian captivity. Perhaps this is why some have identified the cleansing of the sanctuary of verse 14 with the Maccabean revolt against the Seleucid Empire in the middle of the 2nd century BC. By this time, the Seleucid Empire had eclipsed the other three and likely seemed to be returning to resurrect past imperial glory. Antiochus IV, the ruler of that empire, profaned the temple in Jerusalem, and the latter cleansing of the temple from that destruction by the Jews is what is celebrated with Hanukkah each year. However, if we look for an exact literal fulfillment of the 2300 days mentioned in Daniel in relation to the Maccabean revolt, we won't find it. But if it was speculation on the part of the writer, it was not far off, for the time between the desecration and the cleansing was between 6 and 7 years, or between 2,160 and 2,520 days. It is possible that this chapter and the ones to follow, grafted onto the Aramaic text, were an attempt to grant prophetic significance to the Maccabees and what they were trying to accomplish for the Jews. Ironically, it was the political machinations of the Maccabees that may have ushered in the era of the terrible beast of chapter 7. The revolt ended when Antiochus IV died and his army withdrew. But perhaps fearful of further Syrian incursions, the Maccabees allied themselves with Rome, ultimately setting the stage for Roman dominance and occupation of the Levant. Although not really documented in chapter 8, this was the power to come, the power that would be overcome by the kingdom of God, as written in chapters 2 and 7, but not before crucifying God's Son. Chapter 8 appears to recast that scenario into the ongoing struggle against the Syrians, and perhaps reflects a Jewish perception that they are the kingdom of God that Daniel refers to. This may be further understood by the apparent belief of the Jewish people in the New Testament, and even held by some today, that the Messiah was to have been a conquering king who had come to set the Jewish people free from their oppressors, like a contemporary Moses. When Jesus was slain, the disciples knew differently and mourned the loss. But for the rest of the Jews, he really wasn't the Messiah anyway, so what was the big deal? At this point, I should probably mention that for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, taking the statement in Daniel 8:14 literally is considered an inerrant position. Interpreting it as 2300 years based on the idea of a year for a day, as in Numbers 14:34, William Miller determined that Jesus would return in 1844. In spite of Jesus' warnings about date setting and the questionable universality of a day for a year for prophetic time periods, those who continued to cling to Miller's calculations decided that he was correct in all aspects except what Jesus was to do at that time. Hiram Edson, a Baptist faith healer who was in fellowship with the disappointed Adventists, told the group he was with that it wasn't Jesus coming to earth, but rather his entry into the holiest of holies and the beginning of the investigative judgment as to whom shall be saved. Whether truth or artifice, it cannot be established beyond question. It is like trying to prove the existence of God. It is a matter of faith. Although there is nothing salvific about such a belief, Seventh-day Adventists have chosen to make it one of their fundamentals. In other words, while it won't keep one out of heaven, it may keep one out of the church. Why is this so? Perhaps we can find the answer simply by referring to social media, where discussions too often evolve into heated arguments with people blocking one another from future contact over sometimes very trivial disputes. What is apparent from all of that is that sometimes the hardest thing for each of us to do is to admit that we were wrong and move on from there. Instead, with confirmational bias, we look for every possible way to justify ourselves. Then, buttressed by those proofs, we tend to make our position an inerrant platform whereby we test everyone to see if they are worthy of fellowship with us. Churches are often nothing more than a corporate manifestation of this individual behavior. Instead of boiling down things to what is truly essential to salvation, as Jesus did with his parables, we tend to make things more and more complicated over time until we end up with a Byzantine statement of belief that weeds out all but properly inculcated from fellowship. This creates an insularity that pushes each of us to wish to only deal with those who think and act like us. How then do we cross the divide between us and others with the gospel? It is possible to dot every I and cross every T in Daniel, yet never bring anyone to Jesus. But as sad as that is, it may even be possible to feel that we have every prophetic symbol and timeline memorized and properly applied and not have found Jesus ourselves. That would be a tragedy. I hope you have enjoyed this commentary. You may find more podcasts at www.visitstillwaters.com.